You have duct tape on the spine? It's the sign of a good Bible. Sign of a well-used Bible. Good evening, everybody. Give me a second. I'm going to unplug something and replug something and get something working. You know, Brent this morning tried to peer pressure me, and guilt me, in fact, into using Russian literature to open this message. But in the words of Fyodor Dostoevsky in his seminal novel, Crime and Punishment, the fear of appearances is the first symptom of impotence. So I will not give in to your demands. And we'll start it as I intended. Every year growing up, I would go to 5-Day Club. And I hear we are already in the process of planning next year's 5-Day Club, or this year's 5-Day Club, first in a while. If we do a day a month, we should be good. Going to 5-Day Club was always a highlight of my summer, something to look forward to. And then when I stopped being a child participant, I had the privilege of being a volunteer participant as a scorekeeper or a leader, or a scorekeeper or leader. That's all I did, really. And there's things to this day that I have very clear memories of, like the missionary stories and the puppet shows. And the stress of craft, because you had to get it right, or else everyone would judge you, and I was sure of that. And Steve Gonder's annual message. Now, I remember Steve Gonder's message so well, because every year, at least to my memory, every year, Steve would come out and talk about a man named, I wonder who remembers this. Mephibosheth. Yes. And he would go, say it with me. Mephibosheth. And every year he would do this story. And we would all laugh at the stupid name. And I've already lied to you because I don't actually remember it very well. I just remember Mephibosheth. So with Mephibosheth in mind, we're going to turn to 2 Samuel chapter 9. And before we get too hasty, I'm going to open in prayer. This is fresh water, right? I'm not just drinking. Okay. Not that I don't love you, Brent. All right. Dearly Father, Lord, I just want to thank you for this day and this time we can spend together. I just want to thank you for these people, Lord, who I am so blessed to get to spend this time with and share some of your word with. And I just pray right now, I pray for myself that I have peace and confidence. And I pray perhaps even more so that these words aren't from me, they're from you, Lord. And they have value and lasting value that only you can bring and only your words can bring, Lord. So we thank you. Thank you again just for this assembly and this opportunity and this honor, Lord. And we thank you most of all for your son and his death and his resurrection so we can spend an eternity with you, Lord, and a meaningful, love-filled, life-filled existence here. And in your son's name, amen. Let's read from 1 to 13. Then David said, which is the whole chapter, so we could just, that might be easier for everyone. Then David said, "Is there yet anyone left of the house of Saul, that I may show kindness for Jonathan's sake? Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David. And the king said to him, 'Are you Ziba?' And he said, 'I am your servant.' The king said, 'Is there not yet anyone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God?' And Ziba said to the king, 'There is still a son of Jonathan who is crippled in both feet.' So the king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel in Lodabar." Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lodabar. Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and prostrated himself. And David said, "Mephibosheth," and he said, "Here is your servant." And David said to him, "Do not fear, for I will surely show kindness to you for the sake of your father Jonathan, and will restore you to all the land of your grandfather Saul, and you shall eat at my table regularly." Again he prostrated himself and said, "What is your servant that you should regard a dead dog like me?" Then the king called Saul's servant Ziba and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. You and your sons and your servants shall cultivate the land for him, and you shall bring in your produce, the produce, so that your master's grandson may have food. Nevertheless, Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall eat at my table regularly." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so your servant will do." So Mephibosheth ate at David's table as one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth, that's already hard to say. Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah, and all who lived in the house of Ziba were servants to Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate at the king's table regularly. Now he was lame in both feet. First off, David's love for Jonathan and his respect for God, because I'm not sure we can say it's perhaps a respect for the character of Saul, but the anointing of Saul, that God, Saul was briefly God's chosen one to go and fill this role. And David forever has respect for this. When people come and say, "Oh, look, I killed Saul. I killed Saul's son. I did these great things for you." David's response is never gratitude, let's just say. It's not gratitude. But here is this beautiful sentiment. His love for Jonathan, how can I show God's love to someone from this family? From an earlier verse, 2 Samuel 4:4, we know that Mephibosheth was crippled when he was only five. Now Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the report of Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. That's the report of Saul and Jonathan's deaths. When the report came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. And it happened that in her hurry to flee, he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. When his nurse found out that M's father and grandfather, Jonathan and Saul, had been killed in battle, she very rightfully went to flee. And I think we can look back at this woman as a noble woman, because she says, "Oh, my charge is in danger, I will flee with my charge." And that's what makes this a tragedy. And this tragedy is how we're introduced to Mephibosheth. So this man, who is crippled as a boy, is thrust into this position. So we can picture him sitting in Machir's house, eating bread and raisins, when in comes this order from the man who took the seat of power from your family, summoning you to his palace. And Mephibosheth was the heir of Jonathan and who was the heir of Saul. He may have been, at some point, the future king. This was in his line, right? He's the firstborn of the firstborn. This is, Saul has, at this point, two remaining sons. But they're both born to him from a concubine. And one, interestingly enough, is also named Mephibosheth. Saul has two remaining sons, Armoni and Mephibosheth, who were both born of Rizpah. And he also has a number of grandchildren, but Mephibosheth is Jonathan's. He's Jonathan's firstborn son. So all of this status and all of this potential glory, right, is being held by this man. And then David comes, and he claims the throne from Saul's house and Saul's family and Saul's people. So I think for Mephibosheth, terror is understandable. And hatred, although not commendable, would be understandable. But Mephibosheth responds with gratitude and with love and abject humility. In verse 8, which he says after, David has already promised him good things and not death on because of his father. Verse 8 is, again he prostrated himself and said, "What is your servant that you should regard a dead dog like me?" It's humility and it's gratitude. He's the grandson of Saul, who has spent years hunting David. This is a man who was Saul's enemy. But it's also important to remember he's the son of Jonathan, who is the very one who says David and Jonathan's souls were knit together. And he was only 5 when his father died. But I wonder if this this awareness of David and this love for David, I wonder if he knew of it or it was present in his life. And so I'm not sure, but his response to David, his gratitude, love, and humility. There's another character in this story, Ziba. His name is fun to say, but not as fun to say. It's easier to say, though. And he must have some degree of status, because when there's a question about the family of Saul, they don't go to the family of Saul. David doesn't know who, the family of Saul, but someone knows Ziba. So they get Ziba in and they ask Ziba, "Who's left?" And Ziba brings in Mephibosheth. We don't know a ton about Ziba. We know that he's a bit of a family man. He's got 15 sons. He is put in charge. He's got this odd charge here. He's in charge of working the lands. Him, his sons, his 15 sons, and his 20 servants, who go with him everywhere, are put in charge of lands of these restored lands of Saul. And it's their responsibility now to work these fields and these lands and return the produce to Mephibosheth. Ziba and his family, they do this. They do this immediately. They accept the responsibility. But I wonder how resentful that might make you if you could, were forced to become the land manager for the benefit of the useless grandson of a dead king. But he accepts it simply, and he does his responsibility. And so this is where this first section of Mephibosheth's story ends. And we get this interlude. And these chapters in this interlude are such dense storytelling. It's tragedy and war and love. And there's some of the best and worst people you will meet, and some of the best characters who seem so very real and very alive. And you can see, you read through these people and you can see them. You can see them in stories we hear. We can see them in people we know. They're so real and incredible. You have, I made a list here. You've got Hanun the Coward. You have the sons of Zariah. You have David and Bathsheba and an act of horrific betrayal. Amid some of the greatest stories of loyalty, you have Nathan the prophet. You have the birth of Solomon. You have the woman of Tekoa. You have Absalom, and you have Absalom in his love, and Absalom in his pride, and Absalom in his anger. And ultimately, you have Absalom in an act of such ultimate disloyalty to David. And here we see David again. And David is forced to flee from his palace and his home. And with him go a number of people who also all have their own stories. And it made it very difficult to pick, what do you talk about? Because there's so many of these cool people all wrapped up in this. You have Ittai the Gittite. Who here knew about Ittai the Gittite? I didn't know about Ittai the Gittite. He's a cool guy. He's a really cool guy. He's from Gath. He's from the same city that Goliath is from. And he gets the honor of leading the armies of David into battle alongside Abishai and Joab. That's a rare honor. You got Joab, who's a whole bucket of fun. You got Zadok. You have all of his mighty men, who at this point are now one fewer. And these are people, they're also people who try to go, who want to go with David, but David turns them away. You have Abishai, you have, Abiathar, Zadok, and Hushai, who I love, it specifically mentions he's David's friend. I always like that, when people in the Bible have friends. And he meets people along the way as well. He meets Shimei. Everyone loves Shimei. He was another member, interestingly, of the house of Saul. So as he's marching, he runs into Shimei. In fact, we'll read a little bit from that. Shimei treats David slightly differently than Mephibosheth treats David, by the way. Despite Shimei being far further down the rung of royalty here, when King David came to Bahurim, this is 2 Samuel 16, 5-12, for anyone who's keeping notes. When King David came to Bahurim, Behold, there came out from there a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came out cursing continually as he came. He threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David, and all the people and all the mighty men were at his right hand and at his left. Thus Shimei said when he cursed, get out, you man of bloodshed and worthless fellow. The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned, and the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. And behold, you are taken in your own evil, for you are a man of bloodshed. Then Abishai, the son of Zariah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over now and cut off his head. But the king said, what have I to do with you, O sons of Zariah? If he curses, and if the Lord has told him, curse David, then who shall say, why have you done so? Then David said to Abishai and to all his servants, behold, my son who came out from me seeks my life. How much more now this Benjamite? Let him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him. Perhaps the Lord will look on my affliction and return good to me instead of cursing this day. And just look at the humility and grace of David. When he's with it, he's with it. You know, like he's got some big oopsies. But man, when he's with it, he's with it. He meets Barzillai the Gileadite, as well as Machir of Lodabar, which is where Mephibosheth was staying. And they show him and his people love and generosity and honor. And I dub these people unfair weather friends. They see David in a bad place and they say, let us do what we can to help. But the first person he meets before these two, he meets Ziba again. And we'll start again in 2 Samuel 16, just 1-4. Now when David had passed a little beyond the summit, behold, Ziba the servant of Mephibosheth met him with a couple of saddle donkeys, and on them were 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a jug of wine. The king said to Ziba, why do you have these? And Ziba said, the donkeys are for the king's household to ride, and the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for whoever is faint in the wilderness to drink. Then the king said, and where is your master's son? And Ziba said to the king, behold, he is staying in Jerusalem. For he said, today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me. So the king said to Ziba, behold, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours. And Ziba said, I prostrate myself. Let me find favor in your sight, O my lord, the king. This is hard. It seems here that Mephibosheth betrays David's loyalty. David certainly thinks so. His response is to give Saul's land to Ziba and his family. Not just, oh, you tend this. This is yours now, he says. And I just think, isn't it such a relief that we have a perfect, omniscient, just God? That we have a God who we don't need to worry about, is someone going to deceive our king about us? Is someone going to say things behind our back and sway our God? No, he is truth, and he knows truth. And he will see through all of our sin, but also all of the gossip and slander and libel around us. Ziba returns to the palace the victor in here. He has this land, and David continues. He continues fleeing, and so time passes, and the war wages on, and it's another incredible story filled with ups and downs and downs and downs, but it ends with David winning, and he returns, and when he returns, he meets all the same people he met on the way, and he comes back, he meets them all. But now he's meeting them as the victor and not the defeated. And I think this is a great lesson for us. We need to be careful with how we treat people. Are we treating them based on their current circumstances? Are we treating them well because they have good things to give us? Are we treating them poorly because they have nothing to give us? Do we want to be associated with people when it makes us look better? And do we want to distance ourselves from people who we fear make us look worse? That's a problem of mine. This is just pride. This is so much pride, and we need to be careful because we need to make sure that the words that come out of our mouths are sweet enough that they won't taste too bad if we have to eat them. And it makes me think, and so much of the Bible points to Christ, but it makes me think of Christ. And just in Mark, I have Mark 2, 15 and 17 here. And it happened that he was reclining at the table in his house, and many tax collectors and sinners were dining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many of them, and they were following him. And when the scribes of the Pharisees saw that he was eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why is he eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners?" And hearing this, Jesus said to them, "It is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners." Christ spent his time with the lowly people of this world. And I'm not better than he is, you know? My standards aren't better than he is, his are. And I think this is like the most high school sentiment that can still permeate adult life, which is, oh, I don't want to be seen with this weirdo because then people will think I'm weird too. It's like, oh, you know, I waste so much thought on my image, right? And so much concern on how people perceive me. And I just think when God breathed life into dust, I don't think he wanted us contemplating the dust. You know, the glory is not in the dust. The glory is in the life. And that's where our focus should be as well. So David begins his return to Jerusalem. And he stops at the Jordan. And here's where he meets these people. And he meets them all. He meets everyone he's met on the road, he meets at the Jordan. And we get such wonderful, what would you call that? It's a reunion. It's like a family reunion, but Shimei's there. So 2 Samuel 19, 14 to 23, I guess. "Thus he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man, so that they sent word to the king, saying, 'Return, you and all your servants.' The king then returned and came as far as the Jordan. And Judah came to Gilgal in order to go meet the king, to bring the king across the Jordan. Then Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite who was from Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet David. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, with Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him, and they rushed to the Jordan before the king. Then they kept crossing the ford to bring over the king's household and to do what was good in his sight. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. So he said to the king, 'Let not my lord consider me guilty, nor remember what your servant did wrong on the day when my lord the king came out from Jerusalem, so that the king would take it to heart. For your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come today, the first of all the house of Joseph, to go down to meet my lord the king.' But Abishai, the son of Zariah, said, 'Should not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed?' David then said, 'What have I to do with you, O sons of Zariah?'" He says that so much. I wonder if in like the camps of Israel, this is just a common saying. "What have I to do with you, O sons of Zariah, that you should this day be an adversary to me? Should any man be put to death in Israel today? For I do not know that I am king over Israel today. Or for do I not know that I am king over Israel today?" The king said to Shimei, "You shall not die." Thus the king swore to him. Shimei rushes to meet him, and he is singing a very different song. Abishai, however, is very good at holding a tune, I've noticed. So is Mephibosheth, and so is David. This is just more mercy and grace on his part. But Mephibosheth also meets David at the Jordan. Then Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. And he had neither cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes, from the day the king departed until the day he came home in peace. It was when he came from Jerusalem to meet the king that the king said to him, "Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?" That, I don't know if it's sorrow or if it's anger where David asks that question, but that has to be the hardest question Mephibosheth's been asked. David's learned the value of loyalty, and you see it through his whole story. You see it through his whole story is the story of loyalty, his loyal mighty men, his failures of loyalty, when he betrays his mighty men. When Shimei comes and he prostrates himself, David forgives him. David says, "You know, go on your way. We're moving on." But when Mephibosheth comes, well, then David asks him. Because David values loyalty. Mephibosheth had nothing else to offer David. He couldn't be a soldier, he couldn't be a counselor, but he could be loyal. So when David asks him this, I can't imagine it was anything but pain for Mephibosheth. So how can he respond? He can only respond with pleading and with his story. Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? So he answered, O my lord the king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on it, and go with the king, because your servant is lame. Moreover, he has slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God, therefore do what is good in your sight. For all my king's household was nothing but dead men before my lord the king. Yet you set your servant among those who ate at your own table. What right do I have that I should complain any more to the king? So the king said to him, why do you still speak of your affairs? I have decided. You and Ziba shall divide the land. And Mephibosheth said to the king, let him even take it all, since my lord the king has come home safely to his own house. You know what this question reminds me of? Just this question of Mephibosheth's loyalty. It reminds me of, do you love me? Peter, do you love me? You know, it's on the beach, when Peter got to look again upon his king, when his king returned. And what else can Peter say but, yes, Lord, I love you. Well, this is Mephibosheth. This is what Mephibosheth has to say. And so when two people tell two opposing stories, right, who do we believe? And we have a choice here. Ziba has told David one story. He's told David a story in which Mephibosheth saw Absalom's coup as an opportunity for power. And Mephibosheth has told David a different story. In his story, Mephibosheth has asked Ziba to saddle him a donkey so he could ride with David, but Ziba leaves him crippled and helpless and pursues David himself. And here is what rings true to me. I think we can see by Mephibosheth's actions that he mourned for his king. When it goes through the ways he is, he hasn't taken care of himself. He neither cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed. It's not from the day David, you know, the tides of war turned and Mephibosheth realized, oh, wait a second, I've got to... No, it was from the day David left. Mephibosheth said, no, I am mourning now. This is a time of sorrow. This was the absence of his king. And that's what Mephibosheth was focused on. And I don't think those are the actions of a power-hungry, crippled sycophant. I think we can hear by Mephibosheth's words that he loves the king. For all my father's household was nothing but dead men before my lord the king. Shimei holds his household in esteem. He says, look at you, David, you've destroyed these people. You're a bloody man. You've done this horrible thing. Mephibosheth, nothing but dead men before my lord your king. Yet you set your servant among those who ate at your own table. What right do I have yet that I should complain any more to the king? And he's consistent. He's like Abishai. He holds a tune from start to finish. It's the same thing. It's the same story he tells. And I think we can know it by his sacrifice. Let him even take it all, since my lord the king has come safely to his own house. Does he care for his family's lands? Does he care for his rightful title or his earthly inheritance? No, he wants one thing, and that's to be with his king. Also, I find this interesting on David's part. And we all know the story of Solomon, right? Look how wise Solomon is. The women come with the baby. Whose baby is it? And he goes, well, we'll take a sword and we'll divide it. And then we'll see, you know, you each get half. And the real mother goes, no. She can have it, save the baby. Well, this is like that, but inverted. It's like David says, no, okay, we'll split it. You can each have half. And Mephibosheth goes, no. I don't want any. I have you. I believe Mephibosheth. I think he's telling the truth. I think he loves his king. And I don't think he would betray David for something as petty as the titles of dead men. I think there's more to his story than just a compelling story of an unfortunate young cripple. There are no ends of things we can learn from the Bible. And I think there's a lot we can learn from this story. This time, Mephibosheth makes it to David. Last time, Mephibosheth didn't make it to David, right? He was deceived. But this time, there was no stopping him. He knew he was going to be there. And we should learn from this. We shouldn't necessarily be cynical, right? We shouldn't be defined as being, oh, look, it's those cynical Christians. I think we should be defined by these beautiful attributes of God, right, of grace and love and joy. But we also shouldn't be stupid. Mephibosheth had the innocence of a dove part down, right? Oh, we have to be the innocence of a dove. And he had to learn the shrewdness of a serpent bit. Or maybe at least he's just stubborn like a donkey. He's one of the two. And either way, he wouldn't be stopped this time. And he wouldn't let his crippled state prevent him. And I think this is just a universal truth for us. We cannot let, and I cannot let my weaknesses get between me and the Lord. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Well, we know our flesh, and we know where it's weak, and we know how it's weak. We know our specific issues, and more importantly, God knows our flesh. And he knows where our flesh is weak, and he knows how our flesh is weak. Individually, on a specific level, he knows our issues. I love Hebrews 4, 15 and 16. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in the time of need. We are still called to service despite our weaknesses and our ailments. There are no exceptions, and that will be hard, but it is necessary and it's worthy. And we'll need to be cunning. We'll need to be able to have discernment. And when I look at you lovely people, I don't think, what a bunch of snakes. But this is an attribute which we need to foster. And maybe we should stop. Just snake is a really negative connotation in my mind. But discernment, I think, is valuable. And that's part of us. We need to stretch every now and then. I think we need to be able to look at the broken, untrustworthy parts of ourselves and act against them and in spite of them and prepare and pray and do whatever it takes to cling to the Lord. Mephibosheth was a cripple. His whole life he was a cripple. And his life would have been tremendously hard. Imagine his life without wheelchairs or curb cuts or parking spaces. He would have spent a life in total reliance of to others. And that I wouldn't like that. You know, that would hurt my pride. Oh, I have to rely on everyone. In fact, probably he relied upon his servant Ziba. But when you meet your king, it shouldn't make a difference whether you're a cripple or an able warrior. Because what's not asked of us is to stand tall and proud. No, it's to fall down and worship. And this is what Mephibosheth does. He doesn't need the help of others when he meets his king. He falls to his face and he prostrates himself in front of his king. And isn't this God? Like, isn't this just like God? To take our weaknesses, to take Mephibosheth's weaknesses and his brokenness and use it for their benefit and his glory. That's what he does. He has chosen the foolish things of this world to shame the wise. And we have to struggle to stand tall and proud sometimes. But Mephibosheth, he was used to being lowly. So when he saw his king, there was no battle with pride. It was straight to the ground. And Mephibosheth was deceived once, and he wouldn't let it happen again. I suspect if there were no donkeys left, he would have taken a sheep. And if there were no sheep left, David would have met him on the road, crawling on bruised hands. Mephibosheth was going to meet David that day. Mephibosheth is a story of access without merit. It is grace and it's mercy. And the Old Testament is filled, like it is from front to back. It is filled with these beautiful, partial pictures of Christ, right? We get this throughout. The entire book is looking forward to Christ. And I think we see this here. David invites Mephibosheth to eat at his table as one of his sons, not for any merit of Mephibosheth's, but out of grace and love. And that's our story. We are welcomed to a feast, but not through any merit of our own. Only that when the father looks upon us, he sees his son. And when David looks upon Mephibosheth, he sees Jonathan, the one he loved. And he says, Mephibosheth, not because of your own goodness, but because of my love for your father, I will honor you thusly. So how else can Mephibosheth respond but with joy and gratitude? And I think when Christ returns, and before he returns, I want to be like Mephibosheth here. Because honestly, I'm not sure I can even fault Ziba too much. You know, he's been put in this position where for years he's had to work the land of a man who can't contribute, who lives in Jerusalem and dines with the king. And he and his whole family work this land. And from a worldly standpoint, he's made some clever, but scummy decisions to maximize the future of his house. It honestly sounds a little bit like Jacob. But he helps David multiple times, and he respects the king's authority. Like, Ziba's not the worst character in the Bible. He's not a Shimei. He's not doing what Mephibosheth is. He's not living for a better thing. He's living for this world. So when Mephibosheth views his life is this. When David is gone, he doesn't care for his body, but instead eagerly awaits his return. He mourns in David's mourning, and he rejoices in David's rejoicing. And he has no stock in this land. When I look around and think, what are my goals? What are my ambitions? I look around this land too much. I look around this kingdom too much. Mephibosheth didn't. He was waiting for his king. We're not living for this kingdom, for land and wealth and success. I think it's too easy to forget that this land is currently ruled by evil. And I think to fight for greatness and grandeur in its ranks, I think that's just to seek to be heirs of death. And we have a much better opportunity. And how much better is it to be a cripple eating at the table of a king than an able-bodied heir of death starving in the pleasures of the world? Knowing we are heirs, not to an earthly throne, but of a divine inheritance. Maybe now there is someone on our king's throne, but someday our king is going to return, right? And he's going to claim it. And when he returns, I don't want to be in Jerusalem. I want to be at the Jordan. I want to be eagerly waiting, and I want to be able to say, Lord, let him take it all, since my Lord the King has come safely to his own house. I want to meet Christ there. I want to be waiting for him here, and I want to be anxious for his return. It's a little early, but let's just pray. Dearly Father, Lord, I just want to thank you very much again just for this opportunity, and I want to thank you for the beauty of your word, and the constant reminder of your Son in it, Lord, and I just pray that we can all strive to be like him and be anxiously awaiting his return and living a life of service, not to this world and not to the things of this world, Lord, but to your kingdom, Lord. And we thank you for this opportunity to do so, Lord. And I pray for myself that I wouldn't squander it. And I thank you so much for these opportunities you've given me, Lord. And I think of all of the resources and opportunities you've given me, Lord. And I don't want to bury it. I don't want to invest it in this world, Lord. I want to give it to you, Lord. And that's difficult. So I pray for the courage for not just myself, but for everyone, and the focus, to focus on you and not this world, Lord. And again, I just thank you for this wonderful assembly, and your wonderful word and your wonderful Son, Lord. In your Son's name, amen.